Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy with Guy Swan. That is me. And we are jumping back into the piece that we started yesterday. Again, this is going to take a number of episodes to get through, but it's awesome. We talked a lot in the commentary yesterday in kind of re-explaining some of the basic ideas of like hard money and soft money, the whole store of value, like what solution money provides, like what is it that good can provide that other goods cannot. Like salability across time, transporting across space and scales. So there's a lot of really good stuff in the other one, and we are starting back here with money is a social network. And this is another one that, this is a really great analogy, which is why I talked about a lot of yesterday's commentary on money as a language, and this falls perfectly in line and will flow right into this next section. So, and this is all Robert Breedlove's piece, by the way. It's Money, Bitcoin, and Time. So if you actually want to dig in and read it yourself, I will have the links in the show notes and everything available, and so you can check out the Parallax Digital blog, because there is a ton of other great stuff to go digging through. All right. So let's go ahead and just jump right back in. Again, this is part two of Robert Breedlove's Money, Bitcoin, and Time. Money is a social network. Money as a value system, which connects people across time and space, is the original and largest social network. The value of a network is a reflection of the total number of possible connections it allows. Similar to the telephone and modern social media platforms, a monetary network becomes exponentially more valuable as more people join it because the number of possible connections it allows is proportional to the square of the number of its total network participants, a relationship defined by Metcalfe's law. In a monetary network, more possible connections means more salability and a broader scope of trade. Participants in a monetary network are connected by their use of a common form of money to express and store value. Network effects, defined as the incremental benefit attained by adding a new member to a network for all existing members in that same network, encourage people to adopt a single form of money. Intuitively, a monetary good that holds value across time, hard money, is always preferable to one that loses value, soft money. This causes people to naturally gravitate to the hardest form of money available to them. Further, since human exchange is a singular communal phenomenon, suffering from a three-dimensional non-coincidence of wants problem, any monetary good that can solve all three dimensions of this problem will win the entire or vast majority of the market. For these reasons, a free market for money exhibits a winner-take-all, or at least a winner-takes-most dynamic. Network effects accelerate people's natural coalescence around a single monetary technology, since larger monetary networks support higher salability of the monetary good involved. However, the selection of a monetary good is limited by the technological realities of the markets selecting. This can impede the winner-take-all dynamic, since particular monetary goods each satisfy the desirable traits of money to greater or lesser extents. Monetary traits. As we will see, markets have naturally and spontaneously selected the monetary good which best satisfies a variety of desirable traits that determine how useful a particular monetary good is as a form of money. Hardness. Resistance to unpredictable supply increases and debasements of value. Fungibility. Units are interchangeable and indistinguishable from one another. Portability. Ease of transporting or transmitting monetary units across distances. Durability. Resistance of monetary units to rot, corrosion, or deterioration of value. Divisibility. Ease of subdividing or grouping monetary units. Security. Resistance to counterfeiting or forgery. Sovereignty. The source of its value, trust factors, and permissions necessary to transact with it. Natural social consensus or artificial government decree. And government issued, authorized as legal tender by a government. As discussed, hardness is the singular trait that takes primacy over all others in determining a good suitability for playing a monetary role. Money as an expression of value has remained conceptually constant, but has evolved to inhabit many different goods over time. Like language, which was first spoken, then written, and now typed, the meaning expressed by money remains the same while its modality continually evolves. As the monetary technologies we use to express value change, so too do our preferences. Prospects of prosperity. In economics, a critical aspect of human decision-making is called time preference, which refers to the ratio at which an individual values the present relative to the future. Time preference is positive for all humans, as the future is uncertain and the end could always be near. Therefore, all else being equal, we naturally prefer to receive value sooner rather than later. People who prefer to defer current consumption and instead invest for the future are said to have a lower time preference. The lowering of time preference is closely related to the hardness of money and is also exactly what enables human civilization to advance and become more prosperous. In regard to time preference, hard money is important in three critical aspects. First, by providing a reliable way to protect value across time, hard money incentivizes people to think longer term and thus lowers their time preferences. As a stable unit of measurement, hard money enables markets to grow ever larger by reducing the costs and risks of free trade, which increases the incentives for long-term cooperation and lowers time preferences. In self-sovereign money, like gold and Bitcoin, that cannot be manipulated by any single party, reduces governmental intervention, which encourages the growth of free markets, which increases their long-term stability and lowers time preferences. A lower time preference is an important part of what separates humans from other animals. By considering what is better for the future, we can curb our animalistic impulses and choose to act rationally and cooperate for the betterment of everyone involved. As humans lower their time preference, they develop a scope for carrying out tasks over longer time horizons. Instead of spending all our time producing goods for immediate consumption, we can choose to spend time creating superior goods that take longer to complete but benefit us more in the long run. Only by lowering time preference can humans produce goods that are not meant to be consumed themselves, but are instead used in the production of other goods. Goods used exclusively for the production of other goods are called capital goods. Only humans with a lower time preference can decide to forego a few hours of fishing and opt to build a superior fishing pole, which cannot be eaten itself, but in the future will enable better results per hour of human effort spent fishing. This is the essence of investment. Humans defer immediate gratification and invest their time producing capital goods, which will, in turn, make the production process itself more sophisticated, extend it over a longer time horizon, and yield superior results per hour of human effort. In this way, investment increases capital goods stocks, which increases productivity. Amazingly, this effect also transforms into a positive feedback loop, also known as a virtuous cycle or the flywheel effect. A positive feedback loop is a process that is recursively energized. Its outputs also serve as its inputs and therefore creates compounding effects. Positive feedback loops play an important role in biology, chemistry, psychology, sociology, economics, and cybernetics. In respect to investment, as more capital goods are accumulated, levels of productivity are increased even more, and the time horizon of production is extended even further. To understand this preference clearly, let's consider two hypothetical fishermen, Harold and Lewis, who start out with nothing more than their bare hands. Harold has a higher time preference than Lewis and chooses to spend his time catching fish with using just his bare hands. Using this approach, Harold spends about 8 hours per day to catch enough fish to feed himself for one day. Lewis, on the other hand, spends just 6 hours per day catching fish, makes do with the smaller amount of fish, and chooses to spend the other 2 hours building a fishing pole. 2 weeks later, Lewis has succeeded in building a fishing pole, which he can now use to catch twice as many fish per hour as Harold. Lewis's investment in the fishing pole could allow him to only fish for 4 hours each day, eat the same amount of fish as Harold, and spend his other 4 hours in leisure. However, since Lewis has a lower time preference, he instead chooses to fish for 4 hours per day and spend the other 4 hours building a fishing boat. 1 month later, Lewis has succeeded in building a fishing boat, which he can now use to go further out to sea and catch fish that Harold has never even seen. Not only has Lewis increased his productivity, the fish caught per man hour, but he has also increased the quality of his production, a greater variety of fish from the deep sea. By using his fishing pole and boat, Lewis now needs only 1 hour per day to catch a day's worth of food and spends his other 7 hours engaged in further capital accumulation, building better fishing poles, boats, nets, lures, etc., which in turn further increases his productivity and quality of life. Should Lewis and his descendants continue to exhibit a lower time preference, the results will compound over time and across generations. As they accumulate more capital, their work efforts will be ever further amplified by productivity gains and enable them to engage in ever larger projects that take ever longer to complete. These gains are amplified even further when Lewis and his descendants begin trading with others that specialize in crafts in which they themselves do not, such as housing, winemaking, or farming. Successive layers of learning and productivity gains and flourishing trade networks are the foundational sediment upon which all human advancement in terms of knowledge, technology, and culture is built. Human advancement is noticeable by the tools we make and the way we relate to one another. From this perspective, it becomes clear that the most important economic decisions any individual faces are related to the trade-offs they face with their future self. Eat less fish today, build a fishing boat tomorrow. Eat clean today, be healthy tomorrow. Exercise today, be fit tomorrow. Read books today, be knowledgeable tomorrow. Invest money today, be wealthy tomorrow. We can all take solace. This compounding force of nature is always available to each and every one of us. No matter how bad the circumstances are for a man with low time preference, he will likely find a way to keep compounding his present efforts and prioritizing his future self until he achieves his objectives. Contrarily, no matter how much fortune and wealth favors the man with a high time preference, he will likely find a way to continue squandering his wealth and shortchanging his future self. These individual relationships with our future selves is the microcosm of the societal macrocosm. As society develops a lower time preference, its prospects of prosperity improve in tandem. Foundation of economic growth. There are many factors beyond the scope of this writing which influence time preference. Most relevant to our discussion is the expected future value of money. As we have seen, hard money is superior at holding its value across time. Since its purchasing power tends to remain constant or grow over time, hard money incentivizes people to delay consumption and invest for the future, thereby lowering their time preference. On the other hand, soft money is subject to having its supply increased unexpectedly. Increasing the money supply is the same as lowering the interest rate, which is effectively the price of borrowing money and the incentive to save. By reducing the interest rate, the incentive to save and invest is diminished, whereas the incentive to borrow is increased. So soft money disincentivizes a favorable orientation towards the future. In other words, soft money systems raise society's time preference. For this reason, soft money, once it is sufficiently debased, tends to precede societal collapse. More on this later. An ideal hard money would be one whose supply is absolutely scarce, meaning no one could produce more of it. The only non-criminal way to acquire money in such a society would be to produce something of value and exchange it for money. As everyone seeks to acquire more money, everyone would become ever more productive, which would encourage capital accumulation, productivity gains, and a lowering of time preference. Since the money supply is fixed, economic growth would cause the prices of real goods and services to drop over time, as a fixed quantity of monetary units chases an increasing quantity of goods. Since people could expect to be able to purchase more with the same amount of money in the future, such a world would discourage immediate consumption and encourage saving and investment for the future. Paradoxically, a world that consistently defers consumption will actually end up consuming more in the long run, as its increased savings would increase investment and productivity, thus making its citizens wealthier in the future. This dynamic would spark a positive feedback loop. With present needs met and an ever-growing focus on the future, people naturally begin concentrating on other aspects of life, such as social, cultural, and spiritual endeavors. This is the essence of free market capitalism. People choosing to lower their time preference, defer immediate gratification, and invest in the future. The foundation of all economic growth is delayed gratification, which leads to savings, which leads to investment, which extends the duration of the production cycle and increases productivity in a self-sustaining, virtuous cycle with no known natural limit. Debt is the opposite of saving. As saving creates the possibility for capital accumulation and its associated benefits, debt is what can reverse it by reducing capital stocks, productivity, and living standards across generations. As we will show later, when the gold standard was forcibly ended by governments, money not only became much softer, but it also fell under the command of politicians who are incentivized to operate with high time preferences as they strive for re-election every few years. This explains why politicians continue to mandate the use of soft government money, despite the long-term harm it causes to an economy, ensuring that it remains the dominant form of money in the world. We will cover soft government money's unnatural ascent to world domination later. When a form of money becomes globally dominant, it finally serves the third function of money, unit of account. History shows us that this function is the final evolutionary stage in the natural ascendancy of monetary goods that achieve a dominant role, which are first a store of value, then a medium of exchange, and finally a unit of account. As economist William Stanley Yevons explained, quote, "Historically speaking, gold seems to have served firstly as a commodity valuable for ornamental purposes, secondly as stored wealth, thirdly as a medium of exchange, and lastly as a measure of value," end quote. Today, the U.S. dollar is dominant and serves as the global unit of account as prices are most commonly expressed in its terms. This consistency of expression simplifies trade and enables a somewhat stable pricing structure for the global economy. The economic nervous system. All right, let's take a break really quick. I'm going to get some water and let's hit our sponsor, and then I'm going to talk through this section, and we're actually just going to continue forward. I want to break it up into a little bit shorter sections just because, again, like I've said before, this is a really dense piece, so there's a lot to unpack here. So let's hit our sponsor really quick, and then we'll jump right back in, and I'll hit some commentary on this first section. All right, so let's start unpacking this thing, and I want to go back to, since this started out as money as a social network, that was the first section we jumped into here. Let's go back to our language analogy and explain what he means in discussing money as a social network. So every standard for, you know, maybe measurement, time allocation, definitions of words, symbols, communities, all of these are networks of some form, because it is only because we share these standards, even when they are suboptimal, that they actually have any value. And some of them persist even against all seeming rational analysis. English, for instance, is a incredibly diverse language. It's got a lot of different words to convey essentially the same ideas, and in a seriously unreliable set of spelling and pronunciation rules. I've heard from multiple people that English is an awful language to try and learn. I've never learned it in my time in which I could actually remember, so I can't really say anything to that, but that's what I've heard from others. But it has incredible value just in its network. If you speak good English, you can very possibly do business almost anywhere in the world, and that's mostly because the dollar is the world reserve currency. It's funny that the money of the world reserve quote-unquote economy actually presents a higher value to the world reserve economy's dominant language. And so, like, the inches and feet versus the more intuitive and simpler metric system is another great example. You know, we can claim all day that everybody's so stupid because we didn't adopt the metric system, but, you know, turn that around and just look, why don't you just adopt it in your own life? Like, it's not because you're too stupid, right? Like, you wouldn't argue that that's why you don't use the metric system. And arguably, you know, it wouldn't be an excuse. We're using a more complex, less intuitive system. So being stupid makes it work less good. You would technically need a better memory and be more knowledgeable to use the imperial system, specifically because it doesn't really make any sense. So I don't think that's the case. I don't think anybody using imperial system is smarter, but it's true that you have to memorize less and account for far fewer conversions or different like measurement relationships with the metric system than in the imperial system. And that's exactly what the argument is that why wouldn't we use the simpler option? But in this case, obviously, it's because you have this natural tendency to know roughly what a foot is. You know roughly what it feels like to go 55 miles an hour if you're used to the imperial system. Or if you're used to the metric system, the reverse is just as complicated and messy because you don't have any personal connection to it. It doesn't have any meaning that's embedded in you. Familiarity to it kills its use as a standard. So this leads us to the whole Metcalfe's law concept. To explain this phenomenon, is that the value of any of these tools is in the size and growth of that network. So even if something has a smaller head start versus a competing standard, that it's actually an exponentially more powerful advantage. Metcalfe's law states that the value of a network, roughly in the value of like the number of connections that it has, is the square of its users. So if you add a single person to a 100 user network, the number of connections does not increase by one, but by 100. Because that one person can connect with each of the 100, and each of them obviously now has a new connection as well. So in the reverse, you could technically call it 200 because you're 200 different ways, new ways to exchange. This is why social networks that do not differentiate in like their use case or like kind of their goal will tend to centralize. It's why MySpace, without having... with basically just being an alternative to Facebook rather than something that's explicitly different than Facebook, is that those alternative networks die unless they have their own differentiator. So like I could make Facebook 2.0 with just a bunch of cool and, you know, really neat features that maybe everybody would want, or the vast majority of the people using Facebook would actually want to utilize. But if none of my friends are on it or none of your friends are on it, it has almost no value. And this is doubly true for languages and triply so for something like a monetary standard. The barrier to a new language is enormous. I mean, particularly for anyone over 10 years old, anybody who has said, oh, I'm going to learn a language and then tried to tackle it and basically given up, which I've done multiple times, knows exactly how true that is. I could literally invent the perfect language. You know, I could dedicate months and months of my life, invent the perfect language that may even be able to save us from a bunch of common misunderstandings. It could save us time. I could make sure it allocated to route around the errors of all kinds of sorts and communications that we usually have. And, you know, maybe even be able to retain some greater sort of consistency over time so that the meanings or definitions don't change as quickly. I don't know. Who knows? Who's ever tried to invent a language from scratch? But all of these things would be greatly valuable. Yet the language at the end of that isn't worth anything. It conveys no meaning whatsoever and solves not one miscommunication, and certainly doesn't save any time if no one else speaks or knows and uses my language. Like, how am I going to solve a communication problem if I am speaking a completely different language than the person I'm communicating with? So the natural barrier to money is actually pretty similar. It seems like it would be less because rather than digging into an entirely new language and set of symbols and way of speaking, is that, you know, I'm just trying to get a new nominal unit, essentially, to judge prices of things. But it's still increasingly difficult to figure out what something is worth if I said it was priced at 123,500 Satoshis. Let's say I bought a coffee this morning for 123,500 Satoshis. I am talking to roughly, probably nothing but Bitcoiners listening to this right now, but I bet barely one or two of you could immediately tell me that that's an overpriced cup of coffee. The lucky hole number of Bitcoin's current $10,000 price, roughly, is really the main reason that it's not that hard, but you'd have to stop and think about it. This makes it roughly a $12.30 cup of coffee. So, but I even have to refer back to dollars to get a sense of whether I'm getting screwed or not. I'm thinking, oh, $12.30, that's an expensive cup of coffee. I have to figure out what 123,000 Satoshis is, and that's despite the fact that I have that extension, that get used to Bitcoin extension that adds a parenthesis and the Satoshi price for everything that I look at online, and I focus and I think about it a lot, and I still am not comfortable with it. It takes an enormous amount of time to get used to this. I've been using Bitcoin for 10 years. Well, okay. Caveat, the price changes quickly, so what was 123,000 Satoshi 6 months ago is very different from what it is today. But you get the idea. It's still not a fast, not a very quick task. I see prices in Satoshis all the time, but I still have a really hard time expressing or relating to it until I turn it back into dollars and I'm like, okay, that is some expensive coffee. Let me go somewhere else. But there's even another layer to this, because the money itself, if it is a really scarce good, in other words, it's an actual money versus some fiat or government decreed money that is only scarce because the government particularly just doesn't have anything to spend at the moment, or doesn't have anything they want to spend on at the moment, well, then it gets even more valuable as new members join the network. So you're doubly incentivized to stay within the network because you're profiting from it. The economic pool, essentially a market of a good like this, is backed by a decentralized economic pool of resources and productivity that are the users willing to participate in the market. So when people say it's like, oh, well, the dollar is backed by the government, it's like, well, the Bitcoin or Bitcoin is backed by all of the users willing to buy it and all of their individual productivity. That's how anything is backed in a market. The value of a car is backed in the market by the fact that people can use a car and people will buy it if there is a product for sale. So this enables the fact that it's a hard money, one that is scarce. As they said, is this a little bit later on in the thing? Yeah, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. It encourages more people to look at it because you have a greater pool of resources behind it, and now you have also the ability to exchange it with a greater number of users. So it's becoming a more common language of money. And over time, you get to the point where you can look at something like 123,000 Satoshis and be like, okay, that's expensive coffee. But it's a very gradual process that has multiple feedback loops to encourage it when we're talking about money, because that increased value encourages more eyes to look at it and encourages the people who have already been in it, incentivizes them to continue to store it and increase its value. But then when you start talking about the security, the number of nodes, the proof of work, all this other stuff we'll get into in the Bitcoin section, you've got even more feedback loops on top of this. And it creates an incredible gravity. There's a great piece by Dergigi. I think it's Dergigi. I just had him on the show. I think it's called Bitcoin's Gravity. I'll link to it and make sure that I've got the right author. I've made that mistake a number of times recently. So hopefully I got that one right. But there's this gravity that pulls people into the dominant monetary good away from all even very similar alternatives. A seemingly small market advantage when we're talking about monetary goods are actually vast chasms because of the exponential effect of that increased user base rather than a linear effect. A user or a network with twice as many users is vastly more than twice as valuable as a network, and then also its value is more likely to stay stable because it's got higher liquidity. There's so many other factors involved, but it's why altcoins have such a difficult problem to overcome that they can't just be like a little bit better in Bitcoin and, you know, kind of be a hard money. They have to be absolutely no question a greater hardness of supply and vastly better than Bitcoin in many different ways for it to make. I think Bitcoin would have to look as disadvantaged against a attempted decentralized alternative as the dollar looks to Bitcoin for something to actually demonetize or turn the tide on Bitcoin's network effect as the dominant money in the crypto space and in the decentralized economy. Either Bitcoin has to fail in some major way or some altcoin has to be so much better as to make Bitcoin look ridiculous. Okay, let's hit the traits of money. Let's go ahead and move into the next section here. All right, so first let's hit the first characteristic, most critical, we've talked about it quite a bit, but the hardness or the soundness of money. And Breedlove focuses on this quite a bit too, which is really important. This is one of the things that I love about this section is how much focus, because it is truly the most critical characteristic. And I say that because all the other characteristics, all the other elements that make a good money are worthless for a good that's transmitting value if this one characteristic does not hold true. If it is not hard or sound money, that is the glue that makes all of these other characteristics desirable. Imagine we have a bunch of characteristics that make a great parachute. Like, we could have one that's made out of different material that's, you know, stronger and lighter. It could be larger, like the canopy itself could be larger, so, you know, it catches more air and puts us down lighter on the ground. How sturdy are the lines? How are they connected to, you know, the parachute, like the canopy itself? We have a lot of really important considerations, and one parachute may be better than the next. But in this analogy, the hardness or the soundness of money would be whether or not the parachute is attached to you. So it doesn't matter how big the canopy is or what kind of lines you're using or how well it's folded, et cetera, et cetera, if you are jumping out of a plane without the parachute attached to you. So in the monetary sense, the supply of the good, of the money, must be naturally limited in such a way that there is no single entity or a machine or some specific authority that can create large amounts of the supply in a short time span to destroy its value, because its value is directly related to its scarcity. It's the whole stock to flow model of how much in producing new supply, how quickly with all of our efforts can we produce more supply of it, an increase flow, in order to replace the entire stock that already exists. It's why silver is not a good money anymore, because it's so easy. It's got a very low stock to flow ratio. It doesn't take a very long time, and if the price of silver goes up a lot, you can produce and mine it much quicker. You can actually see these fluctuations. If the price of silver goes up, they will dump new supply on the market because it's not that difficult to figure out how to get or to produce more silver into the market. So without this key characteristic, money simply cannot hold value. So it doesn't matter if any of the other characteristics hold true. It simply won't hold value because somebody will simply produce more of it until the value, which would be falling during this whole time, matches its cost of production. There is always a hard limit on the value of a good that on its cost of production, because people will just produce it if there is a profit margin on doing so. All right, next up, we've got fungibility. You'll hear this a lot in terms of privacy in Bitcoin, because if there's something that's referred to as Bitcoin taint, or like its history is attached to black markets or whatever, or nefarious activities, because you know your Bitcoin that you end up receiving might have a history of like 1,000 transactions in which it traversed from the time that it was created to the time it got to you. And that's why privacy is so important, because Chainalysis companies and stuff, like, it may actually become a thing that some government somewhere decides that if you've got cocaine on your dollar bill, then we won't accept it at the bank or something. And that's essentially the quote unquote, even though there is drugs in like every dollar bill ever, apparently. You can't really do that with cash, because you can't look at a dollar bill and be like, oh, well, clearly two transactions ago, this was done on the Silk Road or something. Whereas with Bitcoin, you actually have that history. That's why privacy is so important, because one Bitcoin must be equal to one Bitcoin. And it doesn't matter where it is in the system or what its history is. The actual currency, the actual good, must be fungible. And that's what you see with silver or gold, with these commodity monies, is that because of that, like, I can easily interchange. It doesn't matter which dollar I have, it's always worth a dollar. I don't have to be concerned with whether my dollar has, rough edges, or, whether my gold coin is, quite as shiny as the other one. Like, it's just as shiny. It's gold. As long as it's the same exact, what's the word? Carats, the same, like, purity of gold. 1 ounce of gold is 1 ounce of gold. It can always be melted down and reminted into a coin, and it should be just as pretty as the day it was discovered 2,000 years ago and mined out of the earth. So fungibility is really important for it to be used as a currency, because this is one of those things that makes it so that it doesn't matter. So you don't have to think about where it came from, or which Bitcoin or which gold ounce you're holding. It again creates this layer of independence and uniform. Like that's another example, or another word for fungibility, is that it's uniform. No matter which coin you have, no matter where you are in the world, they are all the same. They're essentially the exact same element or commodity when you break it down. And one is no different from the other. And it's really important, because there are so many things that fungibility is hard to come by. Uniformity is very difficult to come by. Like, I can't do this with chickens. A chicken could be freshly cooked out of my oven and delicious and seasoned, or it could be old and withered and, just disgusting. It could be 6 months old sitting in my fridge. It could have mold growing on it. Like, you can't just trade me for one chicken. But if I give you 1 ounce of gold, it doesn't matter if it's been sitting in my fridge for 8 months, which is weird, but, it's 1 ounce of gold, end of story. So, in that same way, Bitcoin or any monetary good must be fungible. This is another critical characteristic that makes it money as opposed to just some other valuable resource. All right, next up, we've got portability. I'll get to that point when we get to security down here. So portability is just the ability to move it. It needs to be exchangeable. It's one of the reasons that I think gold fell away, like gold and silver coins fell away, is because to move or have a lot of value in gold was really inconvenient. And that's sort of why we started using bills, and then banks and credit cards and all these other things, is because the economy became too productive and too fast to actually use a physical money in order to do trade. Because as soon as we had a communications network, as soon as we had the telegraph and the telephone, we could do business from a distance. But you can't, I can't send gold from a distance. It's a very expensive endeavor. I have to put it in an armored car. I can't just put it in an envelope and ship it out. Like, The risk there is massive. And because of that, the portability becomes very, very difficult. And that's the beauty of a digital good, one that's programmable, is that you can build networks with it. For anybody who's really done some digging into the Lightning Network or listened to any Lightning Network episodes, that's one of the most fascinating things about this is you can build like liquidity contracts and update these contracts on the fly to transfer money all around the world in an instant. And then you've also just got the nature of exchanging the keys, of moving Bitcoin from one key to another on the base layer. There's so many options for transporting a digital good. Because it's programmable, because you can create your own environment. You can program in a script the environment and the conditions under which someone else would own it, some new person would own it. And it's so the portability is just not comparable. That's one of the most fascinating things about figuring out the hardness issue, the actual scarcity issue of a digital good, is that there is nothing that can be as portable and as verifiable, which we will get to in just a second, as a digital good. So portability is really important because obviously you can't, if someone can't easily hold it or secure it or move it, have it in multiple locations. Another great example is getting across the border. There's a fascinating story during the collapse of the German mark back in the, I guess this was not, this was World War II. Or just after World War I. I think it was the 1920s. I think the 1920s was the collapse of the German mark. Let me look that up real quick. I'm going to pause. Okay, yeah. 1921 to 1923. And, of course, it was during the Weimar Republic, so it wasn't World War II. This was the collapse of the German mark. And there's a fascinating tale of portability, of value, because when a currency collapse happens within a country for a national currency, is governments crack down, like capital controls come in full force because they don't want to move real value outside of the country. Because the faster value moves out, the less purchasing power they have in the money that they're printing. Because they're printing the money so that they can continue to confiscate real resources in the economy. Because that's essentially what's happening, is that they're printing money at almost no cost in order to get real resources and real costly, valuable items out of the economy, whether it be human labor or resources, guns, whatever it is. So that's the whole purpose, is to maintain the purchasing power. And if all the value leaves, well, then the real resources and people leave the country. Well, then they can't purchase anything. They have they're throwing paper bills at themselves, essentially. So the value has to stay. That's why capital controls get insane during these time periods. So there's this fascinating story of a guy who was trying to get his life savings out of the country. And there's so many like interesting, clever ways in which things were, like, people were tricked, that they would put gold pins or whatever in their hair, like women would, to like put them up, and they would actually hide stacks, like stacks of coins in like a bun. There's so many fascinating stories about how they would get out of the country without being while being searched or whatever by the soldiers, and still managing to get away with their value. But this one was just fascinating to me, that the man purchased platinum with all of his savings, and then turned it into wire, like actually pressed all of the platinum out, heated it and pressed it out and made it into wire, and then made coat hangers, and then put all of his clths on hangers, and then managed to, and I'm not sure if I'm probably painted them or something like that, in order to make it not look like incredibly shiny platinum coat hangers, but then hung all his clothes on them. And then when at the border, obviously they're not going to take out all these hangers and be like, well, this is valuable. He totally made it across the border with his life savings, by hiding it in platinum coat hangers. That's a fascinating story of like portability, but is that he was able to transport it in the face of, you know, someone specifically looking for value. Obviously, that's not very portable. That's an incredibly difficult thing to go, like, to have to make coat hangers to get it across the border. And that's one of the brilliant things about Bitcoin. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. All you have to have is a piece of information. All you have to have is a digital key. And you can, as long as you can communicate with the Bitcoin network, you don't have to transport anything anywhere. You don't have to take a physical item. You don't have to mold a Bitcoin into a coat hanger to get it across the border. You can delete every wallet, every hardware device. You can wipe your computer. And as long as you remember a 12-word or a 24-word seed, depending on you know what software you're using, but if you can memorize 12 words, you can walk across a border, go into another country, and type those 12 words into the same software and regenerate your key, and you've got your Bitcoin. It is the ultimate portability because it is just information. It can be with you at all times. And it's just the whole seed phrase and stuff is referred to. Well, you can actually make one that's custom, but you should never, ever, ever do that because people are terrible at making randomness. It's referred to as a brain wallet. But that's just a really fascinating aspect about Bitcoin or about digital goods in particular, is that it's just information, and there is nothing as portable in today's age as information. All right, next up, we've got durability. Durability is just that it's consistent over time. It doesn't rot. Again, this is something that's incredibly rare, but we don't think about it, is that in 1,000 years, what is actually going to look or be the same as it is today? Furniture rots. Houses collapse from wear. Even land may not be the same, you know, like you'll have a whole forest or, you know, earthquakes. There's no telling. Things are not, like, durability is incredibly difficult to come by. But, you know, 1 ounce of gold, doesn't matter if it's 1,000 years old, 10,000 years old, or, you know, used to be a coin, used to be a bar of gold, is all irrelevant. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't change into anything. It is gold the whole time. It's an incredibly stable element. In that same way, Bitcoin is just an integer. Its system is perfectly durable in the sense that as long as you have the keys, and the system is still alive, and that's one of those things about the redundancy. We'll get into all the Bitcoin aspects later, but durability is another really big one. Then we've got divisibility. To make it a good currency, you have to be able to divide it up into little pieces. Yeah, you have to be able to easily make, like, take half of it and it be worth half of it. Like, I can't break a pencil in half and give you half of it and then say that it's worth half a pencil. Half a pencil's probably not worth anything. I mean, you know, what if you don't get the half with the eraser on it? Oh, you just can't undo anything. So, money, it must be divisible to make it a good currency. You must be able to break it up into tiny shavings to very, very small amounts of value in order for it to be, like, so that you can, that's the coincidence of scales, is that you have to be able to pool a bunch of them together. You know, have to be able to bring like 40 ounces of gold together to buy something very expensive, and then take just a tiny little bit of shavings off of it to pay for something very cheap. And it has to be worth relative, like the comparative value of each must be consistent. Again, it's divisibility is actually a part, it pairs very well and kind of relies on the whole fungibility argument, is that it's uniform no matter what amount it's in. So that's a really key characteristic for its use as a money. And when we're talking about something like Bitcoin, obviously an integer is infinitely divisible, essentially, even though Bitcoin, quote unquote, only has 8 decimal places. That's actually not a hard limit because, we'll get into that later. No reason to go into all that right now. Okay, and then security. Security, I kind of think like it can't be counterfeited. Security, I really think falls right under the line of hardness. It's probably good that this one is separated out because I think it falls in line with verifiability as opposed to, like, that's probably what I would call it, because that was one of the big limitations of gold that made gold collapse as a secure currency, is because you ended up having to trust the banking institution that was holding it for you, or you had to trust the coinage. You had to trust the mint that made your coin, because you couldn't get like perfect verification of a gold coin. Like, you didn't break it open every time and check and then put it back together, you know, every time that you made a transaction in gold. It's referred to as assay. You could not assay your gold every single time you made a transaction. And because of this, we all had to trust, the economy had to trust third parties that were stamping their brand on it, essentially. And that's what made counterfeits. You know, as long as they could fake the brand, essentially, on the coin, you could sneak counterfeits into the economy. And this is something that happens today. Tungsten gold bars are not, in fact, I read some article not too long ago about a central bank that was holding, they haven't even checked, because, and one of the people who found this, it was like a Canadian stamp or something like that. Like, it was like one of the highly trusted stamps of like the gold bar. And sure enough, it was tungsten on the inside. Like, it was all fake. And this central bank was holding it as a reserve. And there was actually a statement from one of the guys who found this out, who worked there, is that, like, we're like, we're scared to death. Like we don't even know. Like, we don't even know, like checking all of these things might be a disaster, because we might find out that a huge portion of our gold reserves aren't actually gold. So that's a bit, and that's a central bank. Like, they're the kings of actually making the verification. That's their job, for crying out loud. When they're holding reserves, they're not going to be casual about like accepting $1 billion in gold and just assuming that it's real gold. They're actually going to check that stuff, and they got bamboozled by this. So that's what leads to highly trusted relationships, which leads to problems like the lack of verification leads to these problems of counterfeit. But I think they really fall in line also with the hardness argument, is that one that can't be easily verified can't be proven hard. Like, what it does is it risks the soundness property by not being secure or not being verifiable. And then sovereignty, that's just the difference between it being a natural money versus a declared money, like a government-issued money. And then government issued at the end. It's probably a good thing that he added government issued, because this is not something you usually hear in the characteristics of money. But obviously, government issued money, like money by decree, is a thing. Like, you can't just get around the fact that like national currencies exist all over the world. So even though it's not a natural money, the barrier of violence that like they essentially enforce, like through a judicial system, that you have to use it, or, you know, you get put in a cage, you have to accept this as payment for debts, etc. That barrier makes it, it's essentially a false market. It's a propped up market. It's kind of like a violence subsidy for the use of that as a currency, even though it does not necessarily have, or by nature doesn't really have, a number of the characteristics that make a good money. So it's probably important to mention that, that takes us through all of the characteristics of money. All right, and then the last one before we move into the next section is about the prosperity and time preference. And he does a really great summary of, there's a piece called How an Economy Grows and Why It Doesn't. And it's actually like a comic. It's a little graphic novel thing that lays out this argument about, like, you know, fishing with your bare hands, then inventing a fishing pole and deferring your consumption in the future so that you have the resources to take the time to actually improve the production process. And this is so critical to understand that this is the only way you become wealthier, is that it takes less time, that your production process produces what you need to survive, the goods that you want to consume, in a more efficient way and with taking less time and effort on your part. So it is the layers of these productivity gains, of the trade networks, the ability to specialize so someone else can make the better fishing pole and I can make the fishing boat, and then we can trade and both of us are doubly or triply more productive. And then also of exchanging that information of exactly how to make the boat, exactly how to make the fishing pole, so that I don't waste a day failing at making a fishing pole and then have to start all over again and save the fish a second time and go through this trial and error process. The more information we have and the more information we can exchange, the better we are at doing these productivity gain, getting these productivity gains and getting these creating this wealth in fewer trials, like with fewer errors in the process. And this is how all human advancement in the terms of knowledge, like exchanging knowledge and learning things, in the terms of technology and efficiency, and in cultural changes, cultural advancements, this is the only way that these things grow or change. Like, maybe you can say that humans have advanced in other ways, but if you're talking about any of the main ones, that's based on this feedback loop of compounding productive efforts, where as things get easier to accomplish, and as we get information and technology that makes things easier to accomplish, we then have more time to make things better, improve the production processes further, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so I want to hit a quote really quick. This from the reading, this is just absolutely fascinating, is it just hits the point home, is human advancement is noticeable by the tools we make and the way we relate to one another. From this perspective, it becomes clear that the most important economic decisions that any individual faces are related to the trade-offs they face with their future self. Eat less fish today, build a fishing boat tomorrow. Eat clean today, be healthy tomorrow. Exercise today, be fit tomorrow. Read books today, be knowledgeable tomorrow. Invest money today, be wealthy tomorrow. We can all take solace that this compounding force of nature is always available to each and every one of us. End quote. And then the extension of that just a little bit further down is, quote, the relationship with our future selves is the microcosm of the societal macrocosm. End quote. This is so important to stress, that the source of almost all of the macro world problems can be found in societal incentives to create micro problems of the same sort. Somehow we have lost this basic truth in all of our economic discourse when it comes to the mainstream. One could argue that maybe this was deliberate because of how much extraordinary profit the government or central banks had to gain from this falsity, but it could just as easily be just total ignorance and a powerful incentive because it grants them so much power to simply not figure out the truth. Why would you question something that was making your life as easy as it possibly could? If the foundation of your life was based on it and your livelihood was based on it, You have no incentive to figure out that it's wrong and stop doing it. So we know our future on an individual level is not more sustainable or a favorable situation than the one we have today if we go $1,000 into debt today. We know that if we don't pay it off quickly, it may very well cost us $2,000 of future money just to get back to zero. We know that we will not be able to spend or we will be able to accomplish less as our future selves because we have to pay off the resources we've already used today in this $1,000 of debt. Yet somehow, we have been led to believe that the exact opposite is true when we deal with incentivizing millions of people to do this all at the same time. And the truth is, the reality is, that it is worse when you do this at a macro scale, because it systemically ties all of our fates together, evenly, and even not leaving out the people who are actually responsible and don't make these bad decisions. Even the savers get screwed because everyone else is so leveraged that services and banks and major institutions become at risk. So it doesn't matter how much the saver thinks they have if the currency itself collapses, and if the grocery store that they shop at closes down, or the bank shuts its doors, they can't withdraw any of it. All their value is just as tied to the millions who made the bad decision of going into debt today. Their relationship with their future selves, it's tied to all of the people who have made bad relationships with their future selves. So it's just a little mind-blowing that such a basic truth gets so twisted to cause such enormous societal, like society-level problems, and something that should be obvious, that creating massive amounts of debt does not make tomorrow better. Like, it puts us in a worse situation where we have to pay off the actual resources plus more. Like, it's a terrible situation to be in, and it does nothing to help anyone. Okay. But anyway, let's go ahead and just wrap this one up. I think I hit most of what I wanted to hit. And I'm really loving this piece. I hope you guys are too, because I think this is just a really great introductory piece to so many of the foundational concepts to understanding Bitcoin. And we'll be getting close into Bitcoin in the next thing. I may actually release two episodes today because I'm just going to keep going all the way through this as much as I can. I'm going to turn right around and keep reading into the next section. So stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe. We've got so much more fascinating stuff to talk about, the nature of money, before wrapping this one section up. And then we will get to the incredible stuff written on Bitcoin and time, and we'll learn how Bitcoin is just one of the most innovative, most sound, and just an absolute breakthrough when it comes to the technology that is money. So stick with me, guys. This is the Crypto Economy. Thank you so much for listening. We will be continuing tomorrow, or well, with the next episode that I drop. We will be continuing with Robert Breedlove's Money, Bitcoin, and Time. Don't forget to check out parallaxdigital.io/blog for tons of other great writing just like this. Don't forget to subscribe. Follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. This is The Crypto Economy Podcast. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.